All right, Kiss Army, welcome to the Kiss FAQ podcast. Thank you for giving us your time today and letting us into your head. I hope we don't do any damage. This is a Kiss-related podcast by the board for the board. We hope that you enjoy.
All right, welcome to the Kiss FAQ podcast. I'm your host, Julian Gill. I've got 69th Blizzard with me.
Hello.
I'm not going to say from the board because the board's currently down. Marcus Almighty.
Greetings.
And Daniel Wies.
Hi.
Staying up late in the heat in Sweden.
Yeah.
How hot is it?
Well, 25 degrees Celsius. And, for me, that's enough. I can't do much more than that. But, the light is out. It's the midnight sun, so there's no darkness. So after this, I can go outside, and it's like in the middle
of the
day.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Sounds like hell on earth. Daylight.
No.
It's only 21 here. But,
the sun. Yeah, we're nice. I think 15, 17 today. That's all Celsius, but I'm not going to convert it for Americans. But
I never learned Fahrenheit. I don't know.
Well, next week in Sacramento, and Ken, you'll get it in where you are. It's going to be well into the triple digits.
Yeah, it's going to be around 100
Fahrenheit-wise. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah. Thomas, Travis, Austin, Brent, thank you for joining us live. So, yes, the board is down. There is no ETA on it being remediated. It is a data center issue. It is outside of my control. If you're bored and don't have someone to fight with, you can go watch the latest episode of the Inner Sanctum podcast that dropped on YouTube yesterday.
Which is excellent.
Oh, thank you. This video we're diving into is Anaheim, 1976. And someone pointed out, Razor, Buddy Ray from Australia, pointed out that Andrew and I previously talked about this show 5 years ago on Kiss My Boots, which I have no recollection of that. But if that was the case, I'm sure my opinion has changed and much more effort went into the production and the recording and the research for this. Plus, new video sources have surfaced since we did that video, so there'll probably be a little bit of crossover, but this new series, we're aiming on 10 episodes, digging into some of our favorite videos, so we'll be doing some discussions on the FAQ as well that tie in with that podcast. Anyone got any new purchases? I have not. I have only bought computer shit this week.
Let me show you.
What did you get, and is it Kiss?
A new t-shirt. Yeah,
oh,
that's a cool one.
Oh, okay.
Alive too.
Looks good. Yeah. Nice one.
Japanese writing on there. So
it
almost
cool.
Looks like that's some kind of like a supposed to be like a Japanese tour shirt or something like that from that era, right? I love it. It turned out great. I was happy with it. And I proposed this year I'm gonna get one Kiss t-shirt every month from the store. And I'm keeping my collection up. So I got the Unmasked, I got this, Creatures of the Night, I got a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm going to try to get one shirt from every album.
No, you have to see how many of them survive that first washing load. Because as Daniel well knows, not all shirts are created equal, are they?
That's the truth. You remember that, yeah.
You had trouble with your shirt? Or?
I bought a t-shirt from Nico. You remember that guy who had Strike magazine? He had a lot t-shirts from the 90s. But I actually bought one from him just a few years ago. And then when I put it on, I didn't even have time to wash it. The arms fell off it because it had been, in some sort of warehouse for 20 years or something. It just fell apart. It was the one with the forks in the head, if you remember that one. Really ugly. Yeah. So I needed that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Ken, have you done any shopping this week?
No.
You haven't bought all
things. I just.
You've been sick or something.
No, I got a. Yeah, right. No, I just.
You're saving up for the Avatar.
Kiss, Billy Squire, Don't Say No album. I got a repress of that. But that's about it, at least for this week.
Let's jump into some topics. We did have some stuff set up, and not having the board is going to be really kind of fun. So we've screenshotted what we're able to, and that is just the way it's going to be. But I think, who was it that came up with the topic of what was the best
Daniel.
Thing? Well, Daniel, why don't you introduce that main topic?
Yeah.
Well, Ken actually had some good ideas that we might do later on, but I noticed that Julian wasn't too happy with doing the prep work, so I thought maybe I could issue an ID with a lot less prep work. And that was the whole reason behind it. And also I wanted to talk in a, you know, positive tone about the replacement players in KISS, because most of the time you hear a lot of, you know, shit about Vinnie Vincent, and he did some great stuff for KISS. And today we're going to talk about that, and also Eric Carr, of course, and Bruce Kulick, and maybe even Tommy Thayer and Mark St. John, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes, so thank you to everyone else who's joined while we've been talking. Scott Hawk, AB, Angelo, Wolf of Nature, Austin. That's a second one for you, Austin, and Travis. So let's frame this and go in order of, you know, influence of, let's start with.
Chronologically.
Yeah, chronologically. Yeah. And we'll start with the live show influence, and I guess we have to start with the first replacement member, Mark, and we're going to go first to you. For Eric Carr, what do you think his most important positive influence on the live show was following his joining the group in 1980?
Well, I mean, obviously the one thing that he definitely added to the show immediately was his, you know, he had that fire, he had that double kick going on. He was very much more of a more modern style drummer, whereas Peter Chris was kind of, you know, very jazz influenced and very, you know, he had a good swing to his drumming. But in this time period, when we were entering the 80s and stuff like that, you know, double kick became more popular and would become even more so as it went on. So his double kick playing was fantastic. Like, overall, he's one of those drummers, and I know I get a lot of heat from Peter Chris fans when I say this, but Peter Chris brought the enormous drum kit on for KISS whenever he was there, but he hardly ever used the fucking thing. Like, he maybe used like three toms at most, unless it was his drum solo. But Eric Carr, when he got that drum set, he used everything. And in the songs, you can hear him go like from top to bottom, like in Cold Gin, like he would do all kinds of huge fills and stuff like that. He actually used that drum set. So I was always pleased to see him do that. And also, he was a great singer. I mean, Peter Criss is a fantastic singer. There's no question about that. But Eric Carr also had some decent pipes there, and he brought some good vocals to the band as well. So I think he brought quite a lot to KISS, and he was a great addition to the band. You know, he's very feisty. He was very creative, and his drum solos got more and more creative as the years went on, as he started adding electronic drums, you know, and he started bitching. I saw this video just recently where they were showing him complaining backstage to Gene and Paul about how the lasers weren't working during the tour. I think it was the Hot in the Shade tour they were talking, and the lasers weren't working. He was annoyed during his drum solo section. It didn't work. So he was very, you know, focused on making sure that all his kind of things were very well done and well produced, because he wanted to keep the audience happy, because, you know, he was very connected to the audience, probably more so than anybody else in that band.
Ken, what do you think about Eric's contributions live, the ones that stand out the most as an influence?
Mm. Well, like Mark said, you know, he's a kick in the butt for KISS when he first came in, and gave a lot of energy. And that may be due to that, you know, like the double kick drum and so on. But I think he made them a little bit more energetic on stage. I think the rest of the band fed off of him. Right. Because of, you know, his energy. So, and as for other things live, I think he was very integral, at least in his drum solos later on, especially around Crazy Nights and, you know, Hot in the Shade, especially with the Syndrums. Is that Syndrums, Mark?
Simmons. The Simmons drums.
The Simmons pads. Yeah.
Yeah. The
Syndrums, what Ace played on Crazy Syndrome, Joe.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the drums that he had, and being able to, you know, do something different in a solo and make an actual song out of a drum solo, and that's just, you know, very 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 cool thing. And I haven't seen anybody else really do that kind of thing before seeing him do that. So yeah, he was always great and energetic and kept the band, you know, in time, and he was just great live, you know. Yeah, and the vocals, of course, you know, real good you know, background singer and even lead singer when he had to. So, yeah, really, really good live.
Daniel.
Yeah, Mark and Ken said most of the stuff I was thinking about saying. I totally agree with them, but I guess I'll go a bit more into detail. First of all, he looked the part, both in makeup and out of makeup. The heavy metal style that Mark mentioned, I can't imagine Peter Criss on Creatures of the Night, for example. That wouldn't work one bit, unfortunately. So he came in just at the right time when, you know, the new wave of British heavy metal started in the early 80s. And then, of course, hair bands were all over the place. I just wish that the double kick drum that Mark mentioned could be a bit more upfront on the 80s albums. Mm. I remember having Kiss Asylum from 85 and not really hearing. I heard that there was something going on in the background, like on King of the Mountain, but I couldn't really hear the double kick drum. You felt it, but I would wish you could hear it. You hear it a lot better on the one they issued in 97, the remasters. Mm-hmm. You can hear it a lot clearer there. And talking about fills, like Mark said, I really loved some of his fills. And he had some balls. I remember when he played on the Unmasked tour in Australia, you know, that famous gig in Sydney.
Yeah.
He actually added a few fills on a song like New York Groove, which was kind of monotonous. Didn't happen a whole lot on the drums. Peter Criss just doom, doom, doom all the way through.
Yeah.
And Eric, he actually added some fills in the chorus that really made the song pop. So I really liked that. And also one of my favorite songs, and I know at least Mark and Julian likes this song, it's Tears of Falling from 85. I really like the way he has some really crazy tom fills in the chorus that sticks up. Yeah. They stick out, and you really remember those tom fills. I think those are really cool. And first time I heard the song, they really stood out, those tom fills. Other than that, he had kind of an unpolished style, I think. It seemed like he shot from the hip at times. You know, he was really into it. Eric Singer was more of a clinical drummer. I liked Eric Carr. He was sort of a wild child behind the kit. So, and as Ken mentioned, the drum solo, of course, and Mark said it as well, but he is the only one that I've seen that can really make a drum solo interesting, both visually and the audio. Of course, the drummer in Rush was so awesome, so he could just, you know, he had such technique, so you were struck by that. But Eric Carr, he made a show out of it, which perfectly fitted the Kiss stuff. You know, it was showmanship.
The Kiss formula.
Yeah, Kiss formula.
Yeah, you touched on something. You know, obviously, I have nothing really to add to the three of you now, but I don't think they learned how to harness Eric Carr. Yeah. You know, because of where they came from, I think Paul and Gene were much more traditional type players, and that's where they'd come from sound wise and the scene that they'd come from. They had never had a Bonham type drummer. They never had a Bill Ward, you know, and Eric Carr wasn't exactly a Bill Ward either. I mean, he was playing pop and disco and R&B and, you know, Neil Young and all that. I mean, Flasher, immediately preceding Kiss, wasn't exactly double bass heavy. My Sharona, you know, or the Cars, you know, I mean, he was playing in the pocket for what the song required, but he was also very good at adapting and working with the tools that he had. I think the most important thing he brings to Kiss initially, and it's both live in particular, I guess, is enthusiasm. A renewed enthusiasm to a tired and jaded band that had been doing it for 7 years at that point, reminding them of what it was like for all of this to be new and amazing again, whether it was in Australia, whether it was in Italy, or anywhere on the road. He was reminding them of everything that they had forgotten or had become immune to. They just expected to be treated in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And here was this new kid, and he certainly wasn't a kid, he was the same age, who was absolutely blown away by all of it and just loved every minute of it. It could end tomorrow, right down to his audition. Let me get your autographs in case I never see you again. Just that fresh-faced, rather than being, I'm going to shoot a fucking Christmas tree, I'm going to crash a car, I'm going to go shopping to buy a vase, or, Diana Ross is waiting for me on line one. You know, he was not a rock star, but he was jumping into that world just as they had learned in 1973 to enjoy all of it. So I think that rejuvenated them in spirit, at least for a while. It was like a vitamin B shot. It kept them going for a little bit, but it wasn't enough to keep poor Ace going.
You remember that dress rehearsal that was recorded where Peter Criss wants cigarettes and
we had a dynasty on it.
Imagine going from that to Eric Carr. I mean,
sorry. That was
the obligatory.
What a trip.
And there again, that, you know, the dynasty rehearsals kind of summed up where the group were, because you hear it not only from Peter, hearing shit from Mr. Paul, Ace Frehley, are you ready yet? You know, attitude.
Paul was really sarcastic during those rehearsals. Well, Ace is not wasting a minute.
But he had a reason
to
be.
Of course. He was fed up with him.
His 7-year marriage, 4-way marriage, was having problems.
Coming to a,
and you've got two teenagers named Kevin, acting out, and both mom and dad are dysfunctional as well, you know? Mm. So, but we're keeping this positive. So, I think we've touched on the studio album and kind of general feel for Eric in each of our answers. Is there anything anyone wants to add before we move on from either of those perspectives, Mark or Ken in particular? Because you talked about solos.
Okay.
About the studio albums. Or just the general feel of how Eric refreshed them.
Right. Now, I'll just say that he was good. He was a team member, and he did what he needed to do on the albums. I think, though, it's unfortunate that Paul and Gene didn't allow more of his material to get to appear on albums, things that he had written. And so I think they didn't utilize him and his talents fully as they should have, really. I think they were all about, themselves, Gene and Paul show. It may be a trust issue, but if a good song is a good song, or a good riff is a good riff, All Hell's Breaking Loose, surprisingly.
Well, don't forget
Under the Rose.
You're talking about guys who are doing it now for a long time, who've gotten many gold records and stuff under their belt now at this point, and they're bringing in a guy who was, breaking his balls on the scene, playing in cover bands like crazy here and there, and wasn't really known, to be that big a writer, I don't think. At least they didn't ever really mention that. But, it's true. If a good song is a good song, but, look at who we're talking about. If Eric Carr went up to Paul and said, Paul, I got a really great song. I think this should make the album for sure. Do you think he's going to take his song over one of his own? I don't think, unless he honestly thinks that it's that strong. I would believe that Gene would probably be more accepting of Eric Carr than Paul would be. I think Gene would probably say, that's pretty good. And he maybe put in a line or two and then give himself credit with it, right? But then at least Eric would be involved in the songwriting. But I think it's on one hand I can kind of understand it, because when you've gotten that far in your career, you kind of want to keep control of the horses and not let somebody else kind of start influencing it. But who knows what would happen if some of those songs like Eyes of Love or whatever that song was, if they used that or one of his other songs that he did, maybe things would have went a bit different. Who knows?
Maybe
there's a lot more songs that he contributed to the band that are known about by the wider public. And it's not my place or time to reveal any of that information, but there is more. You know, you only hear about a few, very few of the songs that he pitched to the group. There are more. Let's move on to Mr. Vinnie Vincent, who is victim number two in a certain sense. Again, the group were learning how to deal with Jesus, I got like air blowers and car horns and squealing tires.
Yeah, we can hear them.
We don't have any police in San Francisco because that'd be too much to hope for. So they were learning how to get replacement members, and they were making mistakes, clearly. But Vinny comes in at a very difficult time. They've lost, in a period of 2 years, their drummer. They're a band of four separate and distinct identities, each of which has followings of their own, as well as the group having a following. Now, Ace, their guitarist, is out of there. I mean, he drives off in his DeLorean, hits a few things on the way, but he's out of there. Daniel, what does Vinny bring in that's a positive? And, you know, let's say the music, but what else?
Well, you have to mention the songwriting, of course, and the songs. That's the whole reason he became a member, I think, because there were some trouble early on. Looking live, I think he worked pretty good live. He was at times very, very energetic as well. If you compare to later guitarists like Bruce Kulick and Tommy Thayer, I think he had more energy on stage than those two. He didn't have the time to really learn the classic solos. If you listen to the Creatures of the Night tour and the Lick It Up tour, at times it feels like he has some trouble, you know, coping with how the songs, how the solos are supposed to sound. But at times he really, you know, hit the spot. And I always go back to that Rio show when he plays the solo for Calling Dr. Love. That's like an updated version of Kiss, a solo that fits, you know, the heavy metal Kiss. And I just wish he had a few more years to work on the solos on the classic songs. I think it could have been really cool. Of course, we all know the problems with Vinny, but the songwriting was awesome. And if you just look at, you know, the previous records and also Creatures of the Night, they used a whole lot of other people in order to write the album. On Lick It Up, there's no outsiders. And that's simply because Vinnie Vincent came into the band. If they had picked someone else, I think they would have needed to bring in more players. But there was something special about his songwriting in the early 80s. I mean, the stuff he brought in, like Exciter, Not for the Innocent, A Million to One, it's fantastic stuff. And you can also, if you look at the next record, Animalize, they need outside writers once again. So that's, of course, the biggest thing with Vinnie Vincent, the songwriting.
Ken, Wolf of Nature has a comment that really is right up your alley there. You know, he was tearing it up in concert in the moment of the show. I wasn't saying, hey, the solo isn't the classic solo. You were there. The rest of us boneheads weren't. So tell us, yeah. tell us how it used to be in the old days.
In the old days, right?
Take us back.
I remember. Yeah, no, I do remember. You know, when he first got on there, and then he starts playing the solos on the Creatures of the Night tour, and I was like, oh, it doesn't sound like, you know, Ace's solos, or, but then you just kind of go, you're just paying attention. You know, he's just tearing it up, right? He's going crazy, and some of it worked, and some of it maybe didn't work. I mean, his solo was really cool. You know, we enjoyed that. It was like ear piercing solo that he did. It was interesting. I mean, he was good live. He was energetic enough live, like Daniel said. Some of those solos could have been more like the original, you know, the Ace, but it still somehow, you know, still worked. And they were they were really energized again, just from Eric Carr and now Vinnie Vincent. They were really, you know, firing on all cylinders at that time, and, you know, real hungry. But as far as the studio stuff, yeah, he was kind of fell into the group by default because they couldn't decide on anybody. They couldn't just, you know, pull the trigger in and hire somebody else. So Vinny was there, was waiting, you know, biding his time, just waiting, hanging around. And they just said, okay, let's just go with Vinny. Obviously, because they knew he could play and they knew he could write. And they helped, you know, he helped them write. And he played pretty good solos, obviously, on Creatures. So, and then with Lick It Up, I mean, yeah, he did. You know, probably wrote half the album himself, pretty much, you know. So, and his solos were great on that he did, except for that, you know, the one that he did, they did use his on Exciter. But yeah, he was really solid. It's just unfortunate that I guess his, you know, personality didn't fit with, you know, Gene and Paul. And I think Eric would fit in with anybody. But I think it was just the Gene and Paul thing. They just wanted to control Vinny. And they, you know, they really, he wasn't going to be controlled. So, but he was great for the band at that time. It's too bad it didn't last longer.
Yeah, I think you nail something, but in a different angle to how I look at it. And this is a positive. His clash of personality and the problems that Gene and Paul had with Vinny, I think, are a very positive thing for Gene and Paul, because, again, it goes back to them learning how to have replacement members. They made a lot of mistakes with Vinny, clearly, and they kind of let him get away, where who knows what could have been. I don't know whether I put as much value on his songwriting, because they had already righted that ship to a certain degree, and we can't go back and say what if, because it simply is impossible. Mm-hmm. But with the Kiss Killers, they had already brought people like Adam Mitchell into the fold. Mickey Free is already in the picture, you know, so there were other quality songwriters, and Brian Adams, for that matter, as well, and Jim Vallance, you know, were all part of the picture before Vinny ever gets his foot in the door. Absolutely, he brought in a new dynamic live. I don't necessarily know if it's a positive or a negative, but I think because it helps guide, they don't quite get it right with the next one, but it helps guide Gene and Paul to better navigate that path. And certainly for what he contributed to Lick It Up in terms of the songwriting, just again, absolutely stunning. Mark.
Well, I mean, a lot of comments were made here that are interesting. The one comment that I found that was interesting was the one that you just made, Julian, about the fact that they righted the ship about the songwriting by bringing Mitchell and Brian Adams and all those people. And while I agree, because Canadians. I love Killers. Sorry?
Canadians.
Yeah, Canadians. And I like that record. On one hand, though, I still have to think that Vinnie Vincent's writing was what they were looking for overall, structurally, and whatever you want to look at it, because why wouldn't they just continue using Mitchell and Brian Adams if they were that good of writers? And they didn't. They went strictly to Vinnie Vincent afterwards for Lick It Up, and they didn't use those guys after again. I mean, who knows why? Maybe they were not available. Maybe they just, you know, didn't want to use many writers again or whatever. There's maybe hundreds of other reasons, but I'm sure if they were that integral to the change of the sound, then we would have seen more Brian Adams written songs, I would think. But, you know, I think they were happy with Vinny and what he brought as a songwriter to the band. I think that he definitely brought a different dynamic to the live performance. His guitar solo was definitely something different than what Ace was doing. I mean, there was a time period when he was using that violin bow on stage, and I think he dropped that whole shtick after a while too, when he was doing that on stage. But you know, look, he had all the potential to be up there with Eddie and all these other guys, because he could do the speed, he could do all that stuff, but he just didn't have the same melodic sense that those guys had. his biggest concern was just flying 100 miles an hour up and down the neck, and that was about the end of it. But you know, you could, anybody at that point could have did that. You know, I think that he was mainly he was at the right place at the right time. You know, I mean, didn't he say that he was hanging out at the studio all the time, even if they didn't need him?
He wouldn't go away.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I think that that worked out to his advantage that he was that kind of personality type that he kind of weaseled himself in almost by being around all the time and making himself available for stuff. I mean,
well, he played the game because he signed the touring contract, but he never signed anything else. So he always had like that piece of bait. It's like, come here, Gene, here, Paul. You know, I'm over here. Ooh, look over here.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, on one hand, I know we're trying to keep it all positive, but I mean, look, Lick It Up was a great record. It was one of the ones that turned them completely around. They were played on, you know, Much Music and MTV a lot. That, you know, Lick It Up and, you know, All Hell's Breaking Loose were played a lot here in Canada. I mean, I remember seeing it all the time on here. So, you know, credit where credit is due. And he wrote a lot of those songs on that album. So obviously he knew what he was doing. But he needed that guiding hand, you know, to keep it within the KISS realm, right? Because we see what happens when he has no control on the Vinnie Vincent albums. You know, it goes a little bit haywire in spots, right? So, but, you know, he had potential. I mean, he had the technique. He could do it. But it's just something up in his mind was telling him that it was more essential and more vital to go crazy on the guitar than to make solos that people will remember. You know,
just real quick, Mark hit the nail on the head there. I listened to an interview with one of the Appice brothers, the one who played with Vinnie. I can't remember.
Carmine.
And he said that he had heard Vinnie do some phenomenal melodic stuff on guitar. And he asked him, why don't you play like this, Vinnie? This sounds great. It's too easy. Too easy. So of course, as you said, Mark, it was something psychological for Vinnie.
Yeah.
It was his mind playing tricks on him, unfortunately. He had the ability, but he never utilized it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't know about Vinnie and the ability to be an Eddie Van Halen. Vinnie strikes me always as a guy who was trying too hard to be Yngwie without the melodic sense that Yngwie or Eddie had. Plus, his roots were very much blues. I mean, look at who he was playing with in the 70s. I mean, he was playing with Edgar Winter, or Johnny Winter, pardon me, and then Carmine and Rockers. He was, and Treasure. He was doing blues stuff when Eddie was taking apart guitars and building them and all that. So I don't know how much I put into that he had the capability, because none of his stuff strikes me. You know, you listen to Cacophony, you know, Jason Becker, Marty Friedman, Paul, what's his name from Racer X, Paul Gilbert. Yeah. You listen to some of the true shredders, Vi, they've, and Satriani for that matter, they have a very distinct technical ability and melodic sense, even if that melodic sense is a little bit off the wall in terms of time and dynamics and attack. So Vinny never struck me as that. He was like,
I'll say this though,
up with a lot of what he was hearing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with what you're saying, that all those guys you mentioned that had something very distinctive to their playing that you could pick out right away. Paul Gilbert, Steve Vai, you know, Yngwie Malmsteen, all these guys. And that was Vinny's downfall, is that he didn't have really something that made him stand out. I mean, if he thinks that, you know, being in a jar thing made him stand out, then that's not really, to me, an identity. But the thing is, though, Eddie was a bluesy guy. He liked Cream. He liked all that stuff, too. That was some of his earliest influences was Cream and stuff like that. So there was a bit of blues in Eddie as well. But you're totally right, Julian. I mean, I think that his biggest flaw was that he didn't try to nail a set style that people can say, ah, that's Vinnie Vincent. But you could do that with all the other people that you mentioned.
I think he should just have continued playing like he did on Creatures. You know, I think he did four solos: Satan Sinner, Keeping Coming, Killer, and Danger, and also I Love It Loud. Maybe War Machine, I don't know. But they're all great. He didn't need to be Yngwie Malmsteen or Eddie Van Halen. He was on the right track, but unfortunately, you know, with his own solo albums, he tried to just be play fast, and it really didn't work, I think, on those albums.
Yeah, George Lynch, love Dawkins, love early Dawkins. But I throw him in with that, you know, all that L.A. type guitars from the early 80s, Mark Kendall, Warren DeMartini, you know,
yes.
those guys who are all good players, but not in the same league as Paul Gilbert. Mark St. John, and here's where we have to be positive. And we remind ourselves, because even though he's such a blip on the radar of history, and I'll start with you, Ken, to how did he positively influence, we'll have to exclude the live show because he was there so briefly, but the studio albums and maybe general feel in the band as well.
Yeah, that's a hard one. All I know is when we first got Animal Eyes, those solos were kind of just crazy flying. Just, you know, it wasn't under control. It was kind of, a lot of it was out of control. And I think, you know, there's the stories of Paul had to kind of rein him in to say, you know, you can't, just don't go. You know, faster is not always better, being the fastest, you know, because Mark has, I guess, had said, you know, a lot, but I can play faster, you know, faster than, you know, anybody else. But that doesn't make you, makes the solo or whatever structurally pleasing, you know. Sometimes it's just too much. So what we got on there was some, you know, blistering solos, you know, and some of them were pretty good. And, you know, I think Paul had to tell him, you know, no, do it like this or that. But, you know, he was the new guy, and I remember, I thought, okay, well, I'll support this guy. You know, he's the new guy in the band. You know, Vinny went off solo, and here's Mark St. John, but I went to the Animal Eyes show, and there's no Mark St. John. It's now Bruce Kulick. It's like, you know, oh, we got another guitarist. So, for the standpoint that he came to the band, they chose him, and he did some cool solos on that album. You know, there's nothing else you can ask. It's too bad that I guess his you know, he had the hand, the, what's it called, writer syndrome or whatever it is, right? That his hand swelled up and that sort of thing. And he couldn't play, or affected his playing. So, yeah, and then the ultimate decision was, you know, Kiss to decide, well, we got, you know, this other, you know, Bruce, and I guess they obviously thought Bruce would be better in the band at that point, and maybe a solos or more, you know, to what they're liking for Kiss in their future. So, that's where it is. You can't really say anything negative about, was he a good guitar player? He was a guitar teacher, and I'm sure he was great. He did what he needed to do, and that's all that matters for the Animal Eyes album.
Yeah, it comes back to them learning how not to make decisions. Vinny almost ends up in the guitarist role by default because they couldn't make a decision. Mark, it seems they outsourced the decision to Grover, and the interview with Mark went something along the lines of, can you play this stuff? They play Vinny's stuff, and he says, one hand or two? Well, clearly he needed more than one hand. again, I think they learn. And he brings to them more of a learning curve of either you're trying to keep up with the Joneses and shoehorn these sorts of players into your band that goes against your natural DNA, and you know he can't replicate solos in the studio, and he's not on the same page as Paul Stanley. But you know what? I think he stayed pretty classy during the whole situation of the 80s. You know, there wasn't a lot of bitterness that made it out into the press until much later. And I think the most positive thing I'll say about Mark is you just see the pictures of him being chill and relaxed. And again, I've seen photos. I don't know whether they circulate or not, but he's on a sofa with Eric Carr, just chilling out, you know, being interviewed and looking relaxed. I think the little Easter egg they included on one of the Kissologies was from Japan was a kind of a cool thing. I think he made the most of a situation that he could, but, you know, obviously things didn't quite work out for him. So, Daniel.
Yeah, you kind of covered Mark St. John there, but I'll just go into detail a little bit on Animal Eyes. I think some of the solos are really great, and what stood out to me was the first track. I really liked that opening part to I've Had Enough Into the Fire, and also the solo on that one. I think that was his best contribution to Kiss, that song. And that's all I have to say about Mark St. John.
Mark?
Short and sweet. The thing with Mark, I mean, because his time was so limited, there's only so much you can talk about with the guy. I mean, yeah, it looks like he was very happy to be in the band. I mean, like you said, that little Easter egg video that you saw in Kissology was a nice little addition to see with him, just to see how he kind of was as a person. And, you know, let's be honest here. I mean, anybody, no matter what period Kiss was in, whether they were at their most popular or even when they were at their low, if you had an offer to join Kiss, you would probably be very excited to do it and would want to do it. So, you know, that he did show that, you know, he had some excitement about doing it. He's probably very happy to be there. But the one thing that struck me about Mark St. John, and I find this, I could feel the pain in Paul's voice when he talked about this, because I've seen this happen so many times with even bands that I was involved with. I said, he strikes me as one of these guys that were overly confident in themselves as a player. And maybe so, he was a great player. He can do a lot of things. But the problem with him was that when it came to working with him and it came to writing and constructing stuff, the man had no memory. I mean, he plays a solo. They tell him, okay, that part's good, let's keep that and do that. He could never play the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. And right there is his downfall, right there. Because I know when you work in the studio with producers and stuff like that, which I've done many times, you know, if you can't do that, then you start seeing the wheels start churning with the producers. Maybe we need to get this guy out of here. And they start with the influence of the other band, or this guy may not be your guy. Because when you're working on songs, you know, you want to make the best song, whether it's and best solos and best everything for the song. And if you can't sit there and play the same thing back, even like a 5-6 second piece, you can't remember that. You know, that's a certain type of player. I can't do that. And some players can get away with that because they're that good that they don't need to play the same thing twice and they could just do stuff that's fantastic every time. But otherwise, for the most part, I know that people want players that can do that can go in and construct stuff, work on stuff. You know, I mean, could you imagine if that guy worked with Ezrin? He would never have, it would never would have flied, because I know for a fact, as much as I don't like Ezrin, I know that he's very much about that. He'll sing you a part, he'll show you something, and you need to remember some of these things and you have to play it back. If you can't remember this shit, he'll throw you out the door. So, I mean, that's unfortunately the sort of weakness in Mark St. John. But I think overall, I think when he was there, I'm sure he wanted to do his best. I'm sure he wanted to make everybody happy, you know, and I feel for the guy, because I'm sure he wanted to be on a tour proper with them at least once, a whole tour. And the poor guy only got to play like a couple of shows. I mean, how can you not feel bad for him?
Okay. You raised Bob Ezrin, saying that he wouldn't work out with him, but he worked out with Alan Holdsworth. I mean, does that compute, Mark?
Who worked out with Alan Holdsworth?
Mark.
Mark St. John worked with Alan Holdsworth? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I think that's the dynamic that probably makes more sense. Outside of a heavy metal, highly repetitive, to almost being an electric jazz player.
Yeah, and that's more
Out of the Zappa mold. But then again, Zappa was very transcriptional and logical. It does make sense musically. I mean, Vai did his transcriptions and all that stuff for him. So musically, it makes sense. But even if it doesn't make sense taste-wise to every ear. So, Mark was a weird guy.
Well, that makes sense. Sorry, just one last thing. That makes more sense now that you mention it, because Alan Holdsworth is a very, you know, improvisational player, very much, you know, flying off the cuff and does a lot of stuff, but it's all within that structure, the music, the fusion, jazz stuff. It works. And maybe that was his comfort zone. Maybe Mark St. John would have been better off doing something like that long term. So
yeah, Bruce said the biggest problem for Mark St. John was his background, his influences, which was so different than what his own and Gene and Paul's were. And they came from the blues, while Mark St. John came from some other thing. And that was his biggest problem, according to Bruce.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Bruce, Daniel.
Yeah.
What did Bruce bring to the band? And you can only be positive about Bruce.
Yeah. No ego. Dependable. But to me, the biggest contribution that he did, if we're talking live, was his interpretation of the solos. So tasteful. What a way to update the A solos, but still keeping, you know, the not straying away too far like maybe some of the other guitarists did. And he was sure able to play every note. And he has put his own mark on the solos, his own stamp. And I really enjoy a lot of bootlegs from the Bruce Kulick era, because when you listen to them, they sound awesome. And right off the bat, I think, right on during the Animalize tour, you have to remember, had not a lot of time to prepare for that one. And he was a replacement kind of guy, and he wasn't sure it would continue. But he nails the most of those solos right off the bat. And, of course, given some time, like during the Revenge era, almost 10 years later, he was making some really cool stuff with those old solos, like the solos from Deuce and stuff like that. And he did some pretty cool co-writes as well. King of the Mountain, I think he co-wrote Trial by Fire with Gene, and he was able to work with both Gene and Paul, and I think it was very much appreciated by the other band members. I think everyone got along with Bruce. When it comes to Eric Singer, you see they are still friends. Eric Carr was very close to Bruce Kulick, and he's still in contact with Paul and Gene. So he was everything that maybe was wrong with Vinny and Mark was right with Bruce. It was such a class act. And I just wish he would have been allowed to play a little bit bigger part in the songwriting, because the final album he was included on, you know, Carnival of Souls, he wrote like, I don't know, 8 or 9 songs for that album. So he had the capability, but as we know, Paul and Gene steers the ship. So, but I think he could have brought a bit more song-wise. Maybe not like Vinnie Vincent, but a bit more. Sword and Stone, of course, was a great song that never made it to an album, and he was a co-writer on that one.
Yep. Pick Me Up's another good co-write by him. Rosetta, I just love that song. Ken, Bruce Kulick.
Yeah, Bruce has always been just a great stand-up guy, team player, always positive. Everything is always positive with them. I think that was a good thing for Kiss. As far as the solos, they were great. They were the finally we were getting back closer to the Ace solos, but he took Ace's solos and tweaked them and made him his own little, you know, solos. And you know, he didn't play it note for note kind of thing. He turned it into his own thing, and he's always looking to improve. He was always improving throughout all those years. From when he started, you could see his improvement as far as his playing abilities and his songwriting abilities. It was constantly improving. So yeah, he was great. Always great. I can't say one bad thing about Bruce. I think he's just a great guy. You know, regular guy, great person in general. And, you know, we've met him, you know, met him a couple of times. I know Joey and I met him a couple of times, especially one time at the at that Peter Chris convention in LA. Bruce came over to the Kiss FAQ, and he was very nice, and we had a chat over there. I can't say anything bad. I think he's just a great guy and a great addition to Kiss. He was the perfect guy for them in the non-makeup era of Kiss.
All right, Mark.
Well, I mean, you're not going to hear a bad word from me. Bruce Kulick is my favorite member of Kiss, period. Always has been, always will be. Since the first day I did the very first episode on here, I mentioned that Bruce Kulick was my favorite member of Kiss. What a lot of things that you guys said is spot on. He has a great personality. He more importantly, he knows how to interact in a band situation. And that to me, and I've heard this from so many different musicians that I know, or even bigger musicians that I've had the pleasure to talk to, is the fact is any band leader or a band will take a guy who's maybe not as talented but gets along with the band over that. Like, they'll take that over talent 10 to 1, because you have to be with this guy like a lot at a time. If you're in a big band, if you're going to be on the road for 10 months, you want to be with somebody who you can get along with, who you can jive with. And, you know, if you're going to lose a little bit of shred skill for that, so be it. I'd rather have a slightly less shreddy player that I can get along with, and that's a team player, than some guy who can, play his head off but is a dickhead, and that happens a lot with those kinds of, in those situations, because, somebody here like that, a Turge Worm person put here, Kulick in a band, in a show band like Kiss, it was so far off the bullseye as you can get. But you know what? I'll disagree with that, because Kulick had all those things that they wanted. He could do everything that they asked musically. He was willing to learn. And that's the thing. Steps and choreography, you can teach that to anybody, okay? But you can't teach talent, and you can't teach playing to somebody. Most of that comes from skill and from from within, or from genetics, some of it too. If you come from a musical family, those types of people are generally better musicians overall, So I don't care about that show band bit, because that you can teach anybody. Give them a couple of weeks and they can show them how to do the deuce part and all those other parts down pat. And you see Kulick doing that later with them anyway. So that to me is unimportant. So, but I think overall he knows how to play the songs good. Ken brought up a very good point that his interpretations of the solos were really good. And so did Daniel said the same thing too, that how he interpreted the old solos was really important. And, they're close, but never perfect. Because being a guy who played a lot of Kiss covers myself, Ace, like in Deuce, for example, he does a lot of these chromatical runs, like, 12, 11, 10 on the fretboard, like those little three runs there. But what's his name? Kulick never does that. He does more like pentatonic runs like that instead, which I find are much better sounding, in my opinion. And I've always preferred Bruce's interpretations of the solos than a lot of the old ones, in my opinion. But that's just me, because I'm such a Bruce guy, right? But his stuff is great. I mean, his biggest plus, and I can't stress this enough, is that he was one of those kind of guys that when he was doing something and Paul and Gene said, "Nah, I don't know about that," he would say, "Okay, great, show me what to do. I'm willing to learn." And that right there won them over 110%. And he had that advantage too, because don't forget, before he came to Kiss, he was in Meatloaf, right? He was playing in Meatloaf. And there's another situation where you had to learn stuff, do stuff a certain way. You have to play the songs this way. So he was used to that sort of mentality already before he went into Kiss. So I think all those things worked out, and overall, I can't stress it enough. His personality, his mindset, and his approach to music is what made him the perfect guy and why he was there so long.
Yeah, I think you nail it with his personality. I think he's the equivalent of Eric Carr to a certain extent, that he's a non-ego, and that's why Bob would not have been a good replacement, because Bob was an ego. Forget the follicle challenge there. Bob was an ego. Bob was very distinct in what he felt. And, obviously there was history as well. A friction had developed in 1982 when he's helping them. So Bob would not, I don't think, have been the right choice. I think Gene and Paul were at that point just besides themselves. And we can't keep doing this shit every year. We're becoming a laughing stock. I mean, it looks like we're the problem. Well, yeah, you were, but, you know, Bruce comes in and he plugs that gap. You know, he's got the toolbox to play in a style that meets their requirement for the mid 1980s without going too far either side of the direction that they have decided that they're going to take sonically. And he's willing, and when given an opportunity to co-write, he jumps at it. He's got ideas, but he doesn't get all upset when, you know, he's rejected or redirected. And I think that becomes his downfall, because he becomes a mat to be walked over because of his easygoing nature. You know, Eric becomes paranoid. Bruce just lets it go until, you know, recent years, and look what happens as a result. But Bruce, by far, I mean, just the stability is worth it in spades. In the most temporary job in town, and he held on to it for more than one album, and he's highly respected by the majority of the fan community, thankfully. You know, the guy's music is being overlooked like mad. You know, that it's a shame, you know, and that's why some of us who became fans in the 80s, you know, like to shout it out loud, you know. And we love the 70s, we love the original lineup, but we also love that band which was part of our youths. So did I get everyone?
Yeah.
Well, who do we have left? Eric Singer. Let's move let's move back to the drums from the guitars for a bit. Ken, Eric Singer. What's the most positive things you could say about his influence on the band, the sound, the live, the studio?
Yeah, well,
in his first tenure with the group,
his first tenure was, yeah, definitely. He was great. When I first heard Eric Singer, I remember seeing him, Eric Singer, when I saw the Paul Stanley solo tour '89. That was my first deal with that. And then when Revenge comes and it turns out he's going to be the replacement for Eric Singer, I mean, for Eric Carr, Eric's the two Erics. I remember doing the meet and greet a couple of years later after Revenge and saying how, you know, great drumming he was, you know, how great he was on Revenge. I thought he was fantastic. So he was different than Eric Carr, but he was a solid, more technical drummer than Eric was. Eric was kind of more free, you know, in his playing, and Eric knew the little technical things, and he grew up, you know, I guess it was, his father was a musician, right? So yeah, he was always great. Great as a band member, always there, even after they got rid of him one time to go do the reunion tour, and then they come back later on. He could have said flat out no, you know, because he was pissed that he, you know, got dropped, I think, at that point. So he was good enough to come back and continue with them down, you know, in the makeup era. And met him a few times, you know, really, really pleasant guy, great guy, funny guy, another class act of a guy, and obviously a great team player in the band itself, you know, so, and can sing, obviously, too, very good singer. So yeah, I can't say anything bad about it. He's another great guy, great, great drummer, was perfect for the Kiss for that era. Later era.
Daniel.
Yeah, Ken kind of covered it, but personally, I think Kiss had learned their lesson, you know, with all the drama with hiring Mark St. John and Vinnie Vincent and so on. Eric Singer actually got a test run, so to speak, with Paul Stanley in '89 on his solo tour, so they knew what they were betting on. They knew that he was dependable. They knew he could, you know, do the chops, and I think that's the big reason why they trusted him and hired him. So good for KISS. They learned from their mistakes. And when I heard Alive 3 with Eric Singer in 93, that actually made me want to play the drums. Because much like Bruce Kulick, like you mentioned, sort of interpreted the old solos, Eric Singer was great at interpreting Peter Criss's drumming, you know, keeping the good stuff and adding more to it without straying away too far. Parasite and Deuce and stuff like that, they are awesome on the Revenge tour. And other than that, he was professional, dependable, clinical drummer. But another thing that Ken didn't mention is when I think of him, I remember watching those conventions, getting videos from those conventions in 95, that convention tour that KISS did, Unplugged. And, you know, the audience shouted out different sort of songs, and sometimes they tried old songs. And even though Eric Singer never played the drums, he knew them. I think that was very professional of him.
Yeah.
He had learned the old stuff. He was, I think he was a fan in the early days, but he must have gone back and listened through the albums because he nailed some of those deep cuts on the convention tour, and I really appreciated that. Bruce Kulick had a hard time with some of the old stuff, but Eric Singer knew them by heart, so I think that was a cool thing with Eric Singer. And actually, he also introduced the stick twirl in KISS. Eric Carr never did those. So immediately when I saw that Detroit 92 concert, I went home and I started practicing the stick twirl. So it was a big influence for me personally. Stick twirling and playing. Yep.
Very important, yes.
Yes, showmanship.
Hey, can you believe that Tommy Aldridge has an instructional drum video and one of the lessons is actually drums twirling? That's actual lesson in his instructional video. I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. But anyways, Tommy Aldridge is a great drummer, though. I won't knock him at all.
Yeah, awesome.
Eric Singer, to me, has very many similar attributes to a Bruce Kulick. Professional, easy to work with. I mean, how many times did Gene say that, you know, just having him around brought the spirit of the band up, you know? And that in itself is one of the biggest things you can do in a band, because sometimes when you're in a situation of replacing somebody, it's never been a good situation when that happens. Most bands don't want to replace people unless they absolutely have to, right? So to bring the spirits back up of the band is a great thing. I think I've mentioned this before a couple times. The drummer in my band that I was in for a long time, my good friend Jerry, he was not a KISS guy at all. He was not a big fan of Peter Criss. The minute he heard Revenge and he saw Alive 3, he was an immediate fan of KISS. He was a huge fan of Eric Singer because prior to KISS, he was a big fan of Badlands. He loved Eric Singer and Alice Cooper when he was with Cooper as well. I mean, as far back then, he had the skills already back then. You know, he was a fantastic drummer already back then. I mean, I was a big Alice Cooper guy. And when he was on some of those videos I got from him, like Brutal World and Brutal Planet or whatever, just fantastic stuff with him on drums. So he brought that over. One of the things that I took a little getting used to for me, but this is the musician part of me talking, is Eric, back when he first joined them, he constantly had his hat going all the time. If you watch when he's playing, his hi-hat was always counting, constantly counting. And that's something that most session drummers and stuff like that are taught to do, like to constantly keep the meter when you're drumming. And like, that's not easy to do, but just to keep your hat going like that and then doing all these fills and blah, 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 catching all these things and stuff. And you're still going, keeping that steady meter. He didn't do that later on. If you watch, he stopped doing that at some point. Like when he came back after he got booted, he didn't do that for a while. It's almost like Paul and Gene told him, listen, all that flash, you need to pull it back a bit. Like I almost got the feeling like on the Live 35 era and stuff like that, he was playing a little bit more simplistically than he did in those earlier days, which I don't know why they did that. I mean, obviously they wanted to keep it more like the Alive era, but that's one of the things I loved about Eric Singer, though, was that his style of playing. that the combination of technique and flash in there, like he was laser perfect with those cymbal mutes that he did. And he would grab them perfectly. Like only other person I've seen do that good is Tommy Aldridge, you know? So great drummer. And I'm big on drummers. I'm a guitarist, obviously, but I'm a big fan of drummers overall. So drummers get me excited. A good drummer is going to be really excited. That's why I love Neil Peart. And I love all these other guys, Marco Miniman, you know, I love a buddy from Judas Priest there. I keep forgetting his name all the time. Scott Travis. And, you know, so I'm into that kind of combination of style, a little bit of showmanship. You know, it's important too, because you're back there in the back. If you want people to see you, you have to do something to get your eye on you, right? And that helps, right? But I think that he helped them in every aspect. I think he brought up the meter on a lot of their songs. And, you know, like Daniel said, like when he just did stuff like Parasite and stuff like that, you know, that was much more grooving. Like did it, that little part before the solo, that did it, that whole section was more lively than any other time I've heard them play it. And that's not a knock to Peter. It's just his style was different in that aspect to Eric Singer. So I have nothing bad to say about Eric Singer. I think that he is what they needed. And I really hope that when they asked him back, that he did give them a bit of shit and maybe make them sweat a little bit before he actually said yes. Because I'm telling you, booting him originally was such a stupid thing. I know they wanted to do the reunion, but, you know, come on, man. I hope he gave them a little bit of shit when they asked him back.
Okay. Ken.
Oh, I already said. Already.
Daniel.
I've already said my piece as well.
But it's me.
It's you. It's just you.
Okay. Eric Singer. I think he was much more natural double bass player at the time he came in and really was able to change the sound dynamic immediately. But I think the most important influence or contribution that he makes to Kiss when he joins the group is he was someone who could take the heat of replacing a drummer who had died. Mm. He was known enough, but not known enough. So he was respected because of his track record in the bands that he'd worked with. I mean, I knew Eric Singer before Kiss, Badlands, yeah. Shit. You know, I was reading about him in Sabbath before that. Mm-hmm. So, and I think even Lita that matter. So I knew about Eric Singer long before he was even in Paul Solo Band. And I think at that point that it's just like, we can't go through with drummers what we've gone through with guitarists. I'm calling Eric Singer. I know this guy. I enjoyed working with him, you know, on my solo tour. He's the right choice. He'll work. He's already played the catalog and he's working with Alice and he's doing this and that. You know, he's the right guy. And I think he was the right guy. He did reinvigorate the band at a time that they needed to. He and Bruce worked extremely well together, and that's not to say anything negative about Eric Carr. Eric Carr's stuff, especially what it transitioned to in 1990 on the final tour, is absolutely spectacular. But he had to grow into that. Eric Singer was ready to go from that and grow from there. So it really was, I'm not going to say an upgrade, it was a refresh. And again, his personality, he didn't take any shit. You know, he wasn't shy. He wasn't blinded by it, but it was a job as well. So he brought a different mentality. It wasn't like Eric Carr, who was, you know, had a certain amount of paranoia about being replaced or not getting songs or this and that. Eric Singer didn't give a shit. He was working with other bands, had done session work. None of it was scary to him, I guess. And that gave him a certain amount of freedom that he injects into the band, because the fans are like, oh, you're not as good as Eric Carr or Eric or Peter Criss. Fuck you.
I think it's pretty awesome. That first tour he did, that club tour, short club tour, I think Ken went to one of those shows. It's perfect right off the bat there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the first show of the tour. Yeah. And it was perfect. It's like, it fits. It worked, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, Eric Singer, yeah, I like Eric. He's just really fun. And, you know, got nothing negative to say. All his contributions to the group have been positive, and how he's handled generally in public some of the negative things that have occurred to him have been, you know, you can respect him. All right, Tommy Thayer. And just a reminder that this is a positive show. I'm going to go first on this one, because I think Tommy brought into the group something that was needed, much like Bruce Kulick and much like Eric Singer. Reliability and consistency without necessarily the personal flair, because he is portraying a character with as much dignity as he did when he was playing that same character in Cold Gin. So he was the right person. Again, they knew Tommy Thayer. By the time he steps into the Moon Boots, they'd been working with him for years professionally in the KISS organization and everything that he had done. So they knew that he could play the solos. He was never going to play them exactly like Ace Frehley, because Ace was always teetering on the brink. You never knew what Ace was going to do, and that was his X factor that made him fantastic. But for a legacy act that had very little interest other than presenting the same show every single night with the same consistency and quality, you could not get a better guitarist to do it and be ready to go, and one that you knew without having to vet and go through the possibility of getting some nut job who didn't work out, than Tommy Thayer. And later, you know, when they do studio work. I mean, I don't know how deep his contributions are, but he's on there, and he wouldn't be on there if he hadn't earned it. So, Daniel, back to you.
Yeah, that's the main thing with him. Consistency and KISS, you know, going to known players, continuing the same path they did with Bruce and Eric, of course. So they knew what they were getting. He did a great job on the convention tour with them, and he was humble, nice, and I think he must be kind of smart as well, because running that convention tour, and he also did some videos for KISS, some editing, I think, and so he was multi-talent, and as long as they played the classic stuff, it sounded great with him. Then they, well, did some Creatures of the Night stuff, and so a great addition, and it was really the perfect choice. I wouldn't like to see Bruce Kulick, you know, wearing Ace Frehley makeup, so I think it was the correct choice to pick another guy.
You couldn't get Buckethead either to wear Ace's makeup. You couldn't bring in someone else.
No.
Buckethead.
He was in Guns N' Roses for a time.
Yeah,
great guitarist though. Yeah. The only criticism of Tommy musically is he sure couldn't do the Unholy solo. Mark.
Yeah. I mean, all the things that we talked about complimentary to Eric Singer and Bruce Kulick is present with Tommy Thayer tenfold. I mean, like Julian brought up, one of the most important things about him is that they were very, very comfortable with him as a person within their world before he even played guitar with them. You know, he helped Paul and Gene with many things behind the scenes. You know, he even prepped those two guys to play their own material, for crying out loud. I mean, come on, man. You know, Ace didn't remember half the stuff he was doing for the reunion tour. Peter Criss had no clue what he did back in the day on drums. And if it wasn't for Tommy Thayer, you would have no reunion tour people. So give him some credit for that at the very least. Okay. So, you know, and people can see whatever they want, you know, that about the, you know, the last couple of years were dull or this, that, and it was backing tracks. You know what? All that shit doesn't matter to Tommy Thayer at the end of the day. The end of the day is Tommy, you know, Paul and Gene said, we're doing this. He just says, yes, sir. No problem. I'll be there. What time do you want me there at practice? And that's what they wanted. And he did a great job. And you know what his reward was? He has a really nice multi-million-dollar house. He has a nice car. He has money till his, you know, till the end of his life now. And, you know, he got a bunch of really cool model guitars that Gibson made for him, endorsement guitars. And, you know, one of the things that he also got done that Ace never got done They had a Tommy Thayer signature amplifier. I didn't see no Ace Frehley model amp ever come out, you know. So I'm not trying to knock Ace, but I mean, here's a guy who they always say, "Oh, this guy's nothing," but I mean, he's a very, very smart business person. And I know Daniel mentioned that too, that he is a smart business guy. He knows what he's doing, not only on stage, but behind the scenes as well. And a lot of the stuff that, you know, Kiss needed to have working to survive as a band, he helped with. You know, those convention tours and all those things that he helped set up back in the 90s, you know, we have to thank him for that, you know. And the reunion tour probably would never have happened if those things happened. So he gets a lot of praise, or should get a lot of praise, even just for that. And his playing is very good night after night after night. I've seen very many videos of Tommy's there playing with them live, and he plays fantastically. One of my favorite videos that I watch is the Sonic Boom Over Europe video, and he does a great job. Him and Eric Singer are really, to me, the stars of that show. You know, they play well. Even Gene was really good in that show as well. They all were, but you know, even those guys. Well, no, but I mean, like, you know, I think from a technical aspect, I mean, Gene was really good. He sang good. I think his voice has always been very strong live, Gene. But Tommy did a great job. And yeah. I mean, you know, could you imagine going through 5 years of Ace and Peter and not knowing what kind of a show you're going to have each night with those guys, to going with Eric Singer back in and Tommy Thayer, and knowing that you can get up on stage with a sigh of relief and knowing that you're not going to have some complete catastrophe happen on stage or a train wreck happen. So I hats off to Tommy Thayer as well. You know, I know people say Ace is my favorite or Ace is that. And Ace is great. He without him, there wouldn't have been Kiss, that's for sure. But, you know, from all the points that matter long-term in a band, he's just not the guy I would want in my band, for sure.
Ken, the final word goes
to... Yeah, well, you guys all said it all pretty much. Tommy has been there from way back from when, well, Gene met, you know, I guess back when they toured with Black and Blue, or when Gene produced Black and Blue and all that stuff, and then he was working for them, wrote songs with them for Hot in the Shade, and then continued to work with them throughout the years until finally, you know, getting that chance to become, you know, Ace's replacement. And no one knew for sure how that was going to go, but it was kind of like, oh, really? You know, but it turned out, even just right from the start, he played the, you know, Ace's solos, you know, spot on, pretty much. You know, it was, and that's what people mostly, you know, the classic fans, I would say, wanted to hear the original Ace solos, because they hadn't heard them played that way in a long time. And he was playing them that way. And so he knew his stuff. And the other thing about him, and including Eric Singer, he would bring up, he tried to get Gene and Paul to, you know, him and Eric would try to get Gene and Paul to play other songs, old, deeper cuts and stuff like that, for, you know, either for live shows or for at least the Kiss cruises, you know, which is good, you know, because they knew the history of Kiss, and they kind of had a better feeling of what a fan, the fans, because they were fans of Kiss. So they knew kind of what the fans wanted. And so they helped, I think, push Kiss to, you know, Gene and Paul, that is, to, you know, go ahead and try, you know, pulling out some of those old songs that they never played, you know, in forever, never played, or, you know, been a long, 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 you know, time period. So he's just been great, great guy, perfect guy to fit in the band through the last, what, 20 some years or whatever. Always a nice guy, you know. Met him, it's just the one time I met him, I guess, with Julian and I was backstage. But yeah, I met him again another time, but anyway, nothing, can't say anything bad, just a real, real good, solid player, and you know, dependable, definitely dependable. So
Well, there we are. You know, so that is the hot takes. Well, there aren't any hot takes. That was very positive episode about the best thing about the replacement members. How did they influence the live show, studio albums, general feel in the band? We go through each member and focus on positive contributions. So that's a bunch as we see it, as we call it. You may agree, you may not. What are some of the positive things that each one of these replacement members, or any of the replacement members that you wish to pontificate on, brought to KISS? Again, it goes back to Gene and Paul and how much they were able to and how they fit in with the architecture that the bosses come up with. So that is the show. Chime in wherever you've listened to this. But for now, we thank you for joining us. And from Ken, Mark, Danny, and myself, we'll see you next time.
Thank you for spending time listening to the KISS FAQ podcast today. All sales are final. There are no refunds. If you'd like, look us up on Facebook or come over to the KISS FAQ message board and discuss the topic we've broadcast today. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes, Spreaker, or wherever you've listened to the show. We hope you'll join us again.